It's time for JT the Brick.
Let's go. Let's pick up the pace. There are high expectations for this team. The Raiders have an established offensive line. You might not love it, but Colt Miller, Dylan Parham, Andre James. We got some big dudes today. Who's going to start that first game? Aiden O'Connell, one. Gardner Minshew, two. I want the ball out. I want the ball out quickly. I want slants. Will the ball get out? One Mississippi, two Mississippi, out.
JT the Brick.
And in the last regime, we took too much time in between plays for no apparent reason. We got to get Brock Bowers the ball all the time. He is a gift from the sports gods handed to us in Vegas. If Bowers comes in with 73 receptions and 11 touchdowns or 9 touchdowns, that changes everything. If I'm wrong, you know where to find me.
And now,
get him the ball.
Here's JT the Brick.
Thanks for coming back, everybody. JT in Vegas on the flagship of the Raiders, Raider Nation Radio, 920 AM. We're going to get to our fifth greatest game of all time, according to me, and a distinguished panel that I worked with this on. This is not Raiders. This is Raiders Radio. This is not the Raiders' top 10 games from the Raiders. It's from our list. Last year, we built the all-time Raider team. This year, we're going through the top games of all time. Very excited about that. It's Red Right 88. We'll get to that in a little bit. But we had a pivot today. It was the first day in pads. I wasn't at practice today. I'm back for a Raider business event tonight here at the stadium. So I'll be going back tomorrow. Vinny Bonsignor tweeting the two-minute drill. Raiders practice. Aiden getting the nod with the ones. Thayer Mumford, who left with a hand injury, was back on the field with the ones. And we're just seeing, you know, Jackson Powers Johnson come along. He should be back sooner than later, along with Colt Miller. Adam Butler had himself a really good day today. So in the interior of the defense, has been playing at a very high level there. So that's good to see. And that's a guy that needs to step up and play big as a roster spot guy who's going to be in some type of rotation, depending on what's going to happen with Tyree Wilson on top of that. As we opened up the show, I told you that I found out today from reading from Scott Spreitzer that Dave Koken passed away. Dave was an icon in this town as not only a handicapper, a sports gambler, a radio host. I started with him back in 1996 at Sports Fan Radio Network. We worked for years here at Lotus Broadcasting, and now Scott Spreitzer, the Las Vegas sports betting analyst. You hear him all over town over the decades. Scott, I wish it was under better circumstances, but thanks for coming on today to talk about Dave.
Yeah, JT, thanks for having me, man. It's been a rough time, you know, especially for Dave over the past year, but you know, hopefully he's moved on to better places, and it was really a sense where we kind of knew this day was coming, and it really hit him hard over the last 5 or 6 days, JT.
Yeah, and you were very aware of him and had a deep friendship with him. What can you tell us about his spirits? Because when he put out that tweet that he was basically telling us all he wouldn't be here much longer, that had a tremendous impact on everybody, and then the news from you today that he passed.
Yeah, it did. And you know, Dave's attitude, I'm not just saying this because we're talking about the guy right now. His attitude was like something I've never seen before. I'll never forget last year. I think he was diagnosed, JT, in May or June.
Right.
And he texted me. He had lost the ability to really talk. He would try to talk, but it was very muffled because it was both in his head and in his neck. And he texted me last year, I'm going to say in May of 23, after he had had his diagnosis, and he told me it's not good, it's terminal, and I'm going to be in the hospital for a couple of days. And so we chatted a little bit back and forth, and then his last text that day was, it is what it is, it's life, no reason to sit here and whine about it, you know, time to move on, who do you like tomorrow? I mean, that was basically it in a nutshell, talking about baseball. And Dave and I have always been close for 30-plus, since like 1989.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about Dave and I is we texted each other probably 10 to 15 times a day, even during his fight with cancer, and I'd go over and visit with him while he was in his fight with cancer. And it was always about baseball, man, or football, or whatever season we were in. I'd ask him how he's doing, and he'd keep it short. He'd say, I'm fine, I'm doing good. You know, what do you think about the Red Sox and Yankees tomorrow? It was an unbelievable attitude to the very end.
Scott Spreitzer joins us. Yeah, your friendship is really important to us. As you shared the stories, Bobby and I met him in 96, 97, and he was pretty important to the Sports Fan Radio Network lineup. It was one of the first ever syndicated sports networks, before Fox, before pretty much everybody there, one-on-one, and we're doing it. And he's working with Pete Rose, a seat I eventually got after a while, and Dave was moving on to a bigger slot in the middays. And I saw the way he worked with Pete Rose every day. But what jumped out at me, Scott, is this is before the internet. This is printers. And he would come in there and print and put things out, and I would sit there and I'd look at him, and he'd come in with four or five newspapers, stacks of them. And the amount of research he did, it's not like it is now where you're really good at what you did and Dave was really good, where it was all at your fingertips via computers and updated lines. I mean, how difficult was it for what he was doing back in the day to stay up to date?
Yeah, Dave was nonstop. I don't even know if the guy slept more than 4 or 5 hours a night, because like you said, it wasn't just the handicapping, the betting. It was also, you know, the TV shows we did together. Mm-hmm. It was the shows he did for Sports Fan Radio Network, and then with Lotus Broadcasting throughout the rest of the most of his life. But what you had to do back then, and what Dave introduced me to, because I was kind of an up-and-comer, there was a place here in town, a shop called Hometown News, and you'd have to actually go there and you'd get newspapers from all over the country. We actually had people who, when we knew they were flying into town, they would bring newspapers from whatever part of the country they happened to be living in and flying in from. So it was a constant case of studying, researching, and as you said, it wasn't at just turning on your computer and firing away and pressing a few keys. And so I would bet that in order to do his show at the level he did, which was obviously an elite level, his handicapping, his sports betting, his TV show, everything that went with it, he had to be researching, I'm betting, 5 to 6 hours a day easily. And that doesn't even include the driving to the shops where you could get the newspapers and all that kind of stuff. So, and I learned a lot from him. And, you know, by the way, in fact, if it wasn't for Dave, I don't know if I would have ever been part of the Stardust line. I did that for 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. And then the Pete Rose show, we kind of had that in common. He got me on one or two seasons in the mid-90s, 94, 95, I think it was, mm-hmm. where I was on every Friday with Pete and with Dave down at the MGM. And so anyway, but yeah, I mean, Dave was nonstop. I've never seen anybody that diligent and work to that level or to that extreme in order to get that information. And obviously, he knew how to deliver that knowledge second to none.
Scott Spritzer, as we wrap it up, we're looking back at the life of Dave Kokin, longtime sports radio host and handicapper who passed away. Yeah, it's none of my business because I don't bet, but I interview a lot of gamblers, as you know, and I always wonder how much of a handle does a gambler have? And with Dave, he was in the same industry as I was, and I didn't know his background from Long Island. And I always said when he was at Rhode Island, I was from Long Island, we'd talk about that, but he had a lot of skin in the game, where there are people now, as you know, that are full of garbage. They're betting $5 a game. They're on Twitter. I'm on this side. I'm on that side. Well, show your ticket. Let us know what you're betting, because you're trying to influence the market and grow your Twitterverse by saying you're on this game, you're on this game, but they never remind you when they lose, and they never let you know that they got skin in the game. Dave did, and I don't know what that pressure's like when he would go to dinner at Mastriani's with Pete, and he'd sit there, and all these games are coming down the wire, and he had real money, his own money, invested in these games.
Yeah, he'd be on radio. I remember doing a lot of radio shows with him, and we'd both have action on a few games or whatever, and Dave would be, you would think he was going to blow up when his mic was turned on if he was losing a game or whatever. And you're right, he had skin in all of his action, and he would sit there and he'd be squirming and all that, and he'd come out and deliver this professional, you know, 2 hours of radio. But that was the case. I mean, Dave was the best I think there's ever been. I've called him the GOAT on Twitter, Facebook, what have you, at being the guy who could do both worlds. I mean, he was in the sports betting world, and he was also obviously in your world of broadcasting, mm-hmm. and he did both like nobody's ever done before. And so just much respect for him. I'm so, so thankful to call him not only a friend, but also my mentor for most of my adult life. But you're right, man. I'm sure you saw it when you were hanging out with dinner with him when he'd start squirming over some of those bets. He was a character, no doubt about it.
No doubt about it. Hey, Scott, I know you got a heavy heart. Thanks for doing this today. If there's anything happening that we could help out along the way, celebration of life, telling our listeners about it on the flagship of the Raiders, please keep us in the loop.
Will do, JT. Thanks for having me on today.
You got it. Scott Spritzer, good guy, great friend of Dave Kokin. And Dave Kokin, C-O-K-I-N, passed away today, and he had a big impact on all of us. All of us who are in broadcasting sports, and especially the handicappers and the gamblers out here, here's the handicapping gambling capital of the world, as you know. So it's pretty big out here. Big, heavy loss, but we knew it was coming for a while, and Dave let us know it was coming. So a lot of people got a chance to say goodbye to him And I texted him, and, you know, nice responses, and that's all you can do because we weren't able to see him at the end of his life. Man, going to miss that guy. Rod's in Sacramento on the flagship of the Raiders. Hello, Rod.
Hey, JT. We're in Newport Beach going to practice tomorrow.
And, nice. I'll see you there.
Hey, sorry to hear about your loss, and, you know, we need to thank you for you sharing some of the iconic people from Las Vegas so that so that we learn about that. Hey, so going back to the Red Right 88, it was a proud moment for all those players. You can still see it when you see the alumni today. And, you know, the week before was my first Raider game that I ever attended against New Orleans with Stabler and Plunkett. And so we were sitting in our home in Oakland that day with the Cleveland game. And, you know, Van Egan was – it was a rough game. It was just, you know, as cold as – and, you know, Van Egan's off the left tackle all day long, had a great game for what you could have. And it was you know, we'll have to give thanks to Sam Ratigliano for his well, you know, it was a decision. They'd already missed, I think, two field goals that day, and the decision was not to kick. And I told my brother, I said, hey, the only chance we can win this game is if they pass, and guess what? They passed, and we win. And but the most outstanding part of that game, the most memorable portion of that game was, I would say, everybody ended up at the Oakland airport. So when the Raiders came back from Cleveland, there were 10 to 15,000 people. You couldn't park. You had to park down at the old airport, Hilton, and walk to the airport.
Wow.
There were so many people. And they had a stage set up. The team came on the stage, and it was so outstanding. I mean, because that was really the launching point of that 84 team, tell you the truth. You know, Marcus was an addition to that 80s team. But, you know, we still had Hendricks and all those great defensive players, and Plunkett. And so that was just an outstanding, memorable game, and the fans knew it.
Yes.
And so
thank you for
that. The next week, we're off to San Diego and win.
On the way to the Super Bowl. Thanks, Rod. Appreciate it. I didn't know that story about the airport and the stage and all that. That's why we're doing this. Perfect reason why I tried to come up with this right there. This is what we're trying to do. We're trying to go back to the history of the Raiders and share memories in the summer while we got a little bit more time before the season starts. Really appreciate everybody participating as we get to number 5 in our series.
We now present the Raiders' top 10 games of all time.
And the Raiders have won the Super Bowl championship. They are the world champs.
The history of the Raiders.
He is going to get inside the bar. Touchdown!
The games that helped make the Raiders one of the most recognized franchises in NFL history.
Just win, baby.
The Raiders' top 10 games of all time begins now. Number 5.
All right, this is January 4th, 1981. The Oakland Raiders at the Cleveland Browns, Red Right 88. The 1980 Raiders posted an 11-5 record, qualified for the wild card despite losing starting quarterback Dan Pastorini to a broken leg in Week 5. After demolishing Houston 27-7, in Oakland in the AFC wildcard game, the Raiders headed to frigid Cleveland for an AFC divisional playoff showdown with quarterback Brian Sipe and the Cardiac Kids. The temperature at kickoff was a frigid 4 degrees, wind gusting at 16 miles an hour. This was the coldest game since the Ice Bowl of 1967. Let that sink in. The weather did not slow down the fans. 77,655 Browns fans packed Cleveland Municipal Stadium. So this game went back and forth. Obviously, due to the weather, there wasn't a lot of scoring. There wasn't a tremendous amount of passing here, even though you had two quarterbacks and two quarterbacks who could make plays downfield. Ray Guy had a big game with some of his punts that was really important in this game. Earlier on, Sipe threw a pass intended for Reggie Rucker, but it was intercepted by the Defensive Player of the Year, cornerback Lester Hayes. Much of the first quarter was about field position. Into the second quarter, Cleveland set out on the field, hit a field goal attempt. As they were looking to try to open up this game, it was clearly to see that kicking was not going to be a priority. Sam Ratigliano, the coach, knew that, and it leaked into his head in the second quarter of that game. A Plunkett pass intended to Chandler was intercepted by Bolton and taken back to the 42-yard line for a touchdown-making score, 6-0 the Browns. The score would stay that way as Ted Hendricks broke through the line to block the extra point. The Mad Stork blocking an extra point in a game of this magnitude. As we continue on, the Raiders would finally score their first points of the game with 18 seconds to go in the half. The Raiders started the drive at their 36, and on 2nd and 10, Plunkett connected with Chandler for 15 yards for a first down. Two passes to King, and Van Egan set up a Plunkett scramble for 3 yards and another first down. On the Browns 37, King started running the ball. 7 yards to the Browns 30. Van Egan gained another first down on a 4-yard rush. As they were trying to move the ball here down the field, 2nd and goal, Plunkett pass intended to Derek Ramsey fell incomplete with 22 seconds left in the half and 3rd and goal. Van Egan ran right and crossed the goal line for a touchdown before the end of the half. The extra point was good. Raiders went into the locker room with a score of 7-6. I mean, come on, this is a game the whole country was watching. As I fast forward, Raymond Chester had a big catch in this game. Plunkett completed 2 passes in a row, one for 13 yards and another for 19 yards, moving the ball to the Browns 42. 2 plays later, Plunkett completed a pass to Raymond Chester for 27 yards. Now 1st and 10 on the Browns 15-yard line. Van Egan ran for 1 yard. An offsides penalty on the Browns made it 3rd and 4 on the Browns 9. Plunkett connected with Kenny King for 6 yards and a 1st and goal. On the 3rd consecutive run by Van Egan, he crossed the goal line for a touchdown. And a point after, the Raiders led for the first time 14-12. But it was so cold, it forced both teams to trade punts on the next 2 possessions. With 4:39 left in the game, the Browns began their possession on their own 25-yard line. Sipe dropped back to pass, but because the Raiders' stifling secondary was there, he had a scramble to avoid a sack. Upon getting tackled for a 1-yard loss, Sipe also fumbled the ball with the Raiders recovering. The Raiders took over on the Browns 24 with great field position. Now the Raiders were playing the clock and ball security. Van Egan had 3 runs for 9 yards on 4th and 1. The Raiders went for it, but were stopped short of a first down. Cleveland took over with 2:22 left in the game on their own 15-yard line. What a drive ensued. On 2nd and 10, Sipe completed a 29-yard pass to the great Ozzie Newsome, Hall of Famer, to the team's 44-yard line. On 3rd and 10, Dwayne Osteen got called for holding and gave the Browns another first down. On the next play, Sipe connected with Pruitt for 23 yards down the left sideline with 1:06 to go in Cleveland. And on the Raiders 28, Pruitt rushed to the left for 14 yards. Field goal range. Cleveland called the timeout with 56 seconds left. On 2nd and 9 with 49 seconds left in the game, needing just a field goal to take the lead, Sipe dropped back to pass and threw a ball into the end zone intended for Newsome. It was intercepted by safety Mike Davis, sealing the 14-12 win for the Raiders and propelling them to the AFC Championship game against the San Diego Chargers. The play the Browns head coach Sam Ratigliano called would go down in history as Red Right 88, the 5th greatest game according to us in Raiders history. We begin with the highlights of Red Right 88 Cleveland with the pick 6 from Bolton to take the lead.
I think if they're going to be effective, they're going to have to start throwing the ball to their backs.
Well, let's see what they go to now. It's 3rd down and 3 for Oakland. No score on the board. 6:23 left to play in the first half. Plunkett takes a look. in the flat. He's intercepted. This will go for a touchdown. The ball is picked off by Ron Bolton. And into the end zone he goes. His second interception of the day. And the defense comes up with the first score of this football game. Ron Bolton interception in the flat. And we're going to Bob Chandler. Bolton took it, had a clear track into the end zone.
Don Criqui on the call. How about that? I mean, Bobby's pulling this all out. Van Egan gets the Raiders on the ground to eventually take the lead.
Third down and two, I'm sure Oakland has discussed whether to go on for two plays or one.
Van Egan takes it into the end zone. Touchdown, Oakland Raiders, and a football game is tied with 18 seconds to play in the first half.
Great movement, Don, by Mickey Marvin and Henry Lawrence. Those two guys move the defense of the Browns a yard, yard and a half back, and that's the only way you're going to gain any yardage today. Get your offensive linemen to do their job, because nobody can bowl anybody over.
Henry Lawrence, killer, right there on that play, too. So the Raiders are up 7-6 as they go into halftime. They come back with Van Egan with another touchdown.
9:26 to play in the game, and the Oakland Raiders trailing by 5 points. John Brody.
Don, you know when they went over on the sideline, they called a timeout to make a decision. Are they going in two downs, or are they going to try for a field goal? They're going in two. I don't see any way they'd try.
Plunkett might call his own number. Van Egan makes no doubt about it. Mark Van Egan crashes into the end zone, and the Oakland Raiders take the lead. The Raiders take the lead 13-12 with 9:22 left to play. Van Egan with two touchdown runs from a yard out.
Two touchdown runs from Mark Van Egan. Very similar to Pete Banaszak, who played before him. These touchdown machine guys in the red zone. Big part of Raider history. But here's the play that'll go down in Raider history as one of the greatest, if not greatest, defensive player of all time. You had Old Man Willie in the Super Bowl, which we're obviously going to get to down the road here. But who could forget the great Mike Davis?
49 seconds to go.
Wrong.
Into the end zone. Was it intercepted?
Oakland
intercepted the ball.
Michael Davis is the man that picked it off. That's just a great play at a very critical time. It even looked like Newsom might have come up with it. The Raiders didn't believe it for about 5 or 10 seconds. It was a one-handed stab. He was one-on-one with Ozzie Newsom. How he came up with that ball is a miracle.
41 seconds left in the Raiders intercept. And they might have iced this one, no pun intended.
Can you hear the crowd? Can you imagine being a Browns fan? You're in field goal range. You're going to go to the AFC Championship game, maybe win the Super Bowl, and Red Ride 88 happens, and it's an interception in the end zone. Now, the logic behind trying for the touchdown was really interesting. The kicker, Cockcroft, if I got that right, yes, the Browns place kicker, previously missed two field goal attempts and had one extra point blocked by the Mad Stork. In addition, the weather was brutally cold and windy. What many people don't know about the situation is that it was a long way from being a 100% physical kick in 1990. That was said in the interview. The kicker had two herniated discs and needed four epidurals just to get through the season. So they didn't want to kick. And they were down, and a field goal would have won the game. But you got to make a kick like that. And they decided to throw it. Final call, the Raiders advance.
Now the Oakland Raiders coming up, as the Oakland Raiders have done so many times over the years. In the big games, they're so tough to beat. The winningest consecutive years franchise in the history of the league. 16 straight winning seasons at Oakland. And now the wild card Raiders, as the clock winds down inside 20 seconds, are ready to head to San Diego in the AFC Championship game against their arch rivals from the AFC West, the San Diego Chargers. And you'll see that next Sunday, beginning at 4:30 here on NBC. What a victory for the Oakland Raiders, coming from behind twice in this game. And they win it as the clock goes down and out.
16 consecutive winning season, the team of the decades. And there it is, Red Right 88. Now, could I put Sea of Hands ahead of it? Holy Roll. You know, look, we're trying to put the games together. But this one was so significant, because it led to the Raiders being the first ever wild card team to go win the Super Bowl and to go into San Diego and win again on the road, to do this all on the road. So what the Raiders did with the help of Mike Davis and the interception truly gave the Raiders a Super Bowl, and that's very significant. You know, Super Bowls are bigger and more important, as you can tell, But there's no Super Bowl without Red Wright 88. He waits for it, and then he's the first one in. Here's Raider 66.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. How you doing today?
Great. Thank you for calling. What's happening?
Yeah, that game was really cool. Yeah, it was very, very cold. And actually, as the week went along, there was a lot of talk about how the Raider players were going to, combat the cold. And that's the first time I heard of men wearing pantyhose. That was the big ways that they were going to get rid of the cold is that the offensive linemen and defensive linemen especially were going to wear pantyhose. So they're looking for those extra size pantyhose at the stores to buy to keep the heat inside and the cold away. But yeah, 4 degrees, the coldest game as you said since the Ice Bowl in '67, and it's very interesting. That season was probably like the dream season for the NFL. You know, they'd like everybody to finish 8-8 or 8-9 now. Mm. That year, all five of the AFC representatives finished at 11-5. So to get the seeding, they had to do a bunch of tiebreakers. And that's how the Raiders got second place and into the wild card game is because the Chargers were given the division lead. They also had an 11-5 record by this weird tiebreaker of most net points against division opponents. That's how far down the list they had to go to get the Chargers the first spot. And then with the other tiebreakers, the Chargers got the number one overall, and that's who the Raiders played in the championship game. But, yeah, had it not been for that tiebreaker, the Raiders could have been at home and the Chargers would have been in Cleveland playing in that cold weather. But it just worked out really great. And as you mentioned, two missed field goals because of the temperature and the wind and the elements by Cockcroft, the blocked field goal by Hendricks, and then they had a bad snap also. So there were three missed field goals in that game by the Browns. So it could have been much worse. And that season, with Sipe at the quarterback, Cleveland was known as the Cardiac Kids because they had a number of miracle comebacks during the season. And this one, they were looking for one more, but they didn't get it. The Raiders went on, as you said, to be the first wild card team to win the Super Bowl. Great game, JT. Love it. Red Wright 88 will live forever in Raider history.
Yes.
Have a great day.
Thanks, Raider 66. Always putting an exclamation point on the history of the Raiders when we go down this road. So I'd like to hear from some other people on Red Wright 88, maybe someone who knows Mike Davis. Maybe you have a Mike Davis story along the way. Eric Edholm is supposed to join us from NFL.com. We'll go around the league with him, get his opinion on the Raiders when we come back. I'll be at camp tomorrow back in Costa Mesa, not driving. For those who are following along, I will never drive again, as in never. That's my last drive. 22 hours door-to-door, never again. So we'll see. Now, knock on wood, with the flights being on time. One of the reasons I was driving, because flights are interesting lately. So we'll be back at camp tomorrow, and we'll have a big show live from Costa Mesa for you. Brought to you by the 872 Laborers, led by the great Tommy White.
No, as far as I'm concerned, they're getting the wrong guy in the dugout.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not changing my mind on things. You know, I'll say if I got it wrong, I'll say I got it wrong.
Yeah.
But as of now, I didn't get it wrong on the Red Sox, and I didn't get it wrong on the White Sox.
That's the voice of Dave Koken, who passed away today, and we're paying tribute to him the entire show. I hope other shows do the same, or at least those who know him and had a friendship with him will do the same. We miss him here. Lotus Broadcasting lost a valuable longtime employee today. A lot of people have a heavy heart. So Eric Edholm is kind enough to join me from NFL.com as we go around the league talking about other teams and the Raiders. And Eric, I've said these contracts are ridiculous. I can't believe what Tua got, and especially Jordan Love. $55 million and $53.1 million. Is this the new standard now? How are you incorporating this contract as you look at the money for the quarterback position going forward?
Yeah, to me, this was the most interesting. Obviously, you know, you could still make a case that Dak Prescott could fill that, you know, most interesting label, but he was the most interesting test case this offseason. You know, I mean, Trevor Lawrence, we had a bigger body of work for. Tua Tagovailoa, same thing. But with Jordan Love, it was basically from November 1st on, right? I remember midseason last year, Brian Gutekunst, the GM, had his little state of the franchise during the bye week. And at that point, you know, Halloween or whatever, they didn't know there was some very hedged language there from the guy making the decision on the quarterback about whether Love was their guy. Now, we know how the second half of the season went. They went on the road, had a great playoff victory. But, you know, let's not forget, he had two fourth-quarter interceptions against the Niners, too. So it is very much an incomplete body of work. Now, I think he's terrifically talented. I've always had sort of an affection for him, just knowing his story and just sort of the unusual path he's taken. But you're absolutely right to question whether he's the guy yet. Now, if he does it again this season for a full 17 games and more, you know, maybe then we say, okay, they got in now, and maybe $55 million is a bargain in 2 years. Who knows?
What's the similarities to Daniel Jones, who was drafted very high and has unbelievable leg talent and can run and make throws and do all that, but he's been so injured? And the Giants could have kind of said, out of that rookie deal, no, we've seen enough. But the guy was hurt, and I know that John Mara loved him and really thought he could fit in the Eli mold. And he got a $40-plus million contract. And look at the mess he's been with the Giants.
Yeah, and certainly that has affected decisions. We saw, obviously, in the offseason version of Hard Knocks that the decision to move on from Saquon Barkley was most definitely tied or at least related to them bringing back Jones, understanding how much of the cap he's going to eat up, and giving him that other shot while also applying a little pressure on him too. Drew Lock's there on a $5 million contract, but still, I mean, somebody who could step in and possibly give him a little run. So yeah, I mean, their decision to bypass a QB in the draft will be an interesting one 2-3 years from now. Even next off season, we'll revisit it. But yeah, that, you know, you don't ever want to make a mistake and then try to undo that by making another mistake, right? I mean, it gets teams in trouble pretty fast.
Eric Edholm is our guest. What's your take on Tua's contract now, knowing that Mike McDaniel went to Stephen Ross and really pushed hard for it? I think McDaniel knows he's not on the hot seat, but he's got to win eventually, and Tua's the guy who understands his offense better than any new player they can bring in down the road. Do you like the fit, and do you think that contract is fair considering what he's done so far?
Yeah, he was obviously another player that I think, you know, had some considerable risk given the injury history, but he did play 18 games last year, didn't miss a game, was more durable, took about the same number of hits and sacks too. I mean, maybe a little bit lower than the year before, but so clearly they were doing something right in terms of protecting him or him protecting himself. But, you know, after the numbers he put up, you knew he was eventually going to get paid. It's great to hear when a coach obviously has a player's back and you know, went to bat for him and made sure that he got his money. But you're right. They're most definitely tied together in some respects, and now even more tethered because, you know, if Tua plays well and they have a similar type of year to last year where it's like we see the high ceiling but we also understand their limitations, what's the next step for the franchise? You know, I mean, there's only so much speed you can keep adding to that offense, and the defense can certainly use some help. But yeah, that's a really interesting situation because I don't think the Bills are going to be down for long. I know the Patriots are in a rebuild, but Jets still have a window here. Tough division.
Eric Edholm is our guest. It is very tough. Have you changed or pivoted or anything changed on Aaron Rodgers missing part of the mini camp? Man, you know, we were supposed to be in fine. What you've seen so far with his communication, and God, that Achilles tear looks great now, from golf to his hike to Egypt to what I've seen in camp so far. Where do you stand with the Jets, as I think they're getting some of the most overhyped coverage I've ever seen for a below average team coming into a season?
Yeah, I mean, right, the Achilles is so good he could have gone to Egypt and, like Alexander the Great, you know, just marched across the desert, right? He's the, no, I mean, look, I you have to be hopeful if you're a Jets fan that you know, maybe it's even a better version of what he could have been last year. You never know, right? These things are so hard to predict, but there was so much hype last year, not just Hard Knocks, but obviously, you know, the result of that trade and you know, some nice young pieces. They had that great draft class with Breece and Garrett Wilson, and you know, those guys are still, I think, top tier playmakers. Obviously Breece still another year removed from ACL. Garrett's going to have his quarterback, we presume, this year. And, you know, the defense, at times played like a top 10 unit, but there were certain games where if things didn't go well offensively early, you could almost see that group kind of mail it in a little bit. And, you know, I mean, obviously Robert Saleh's got a lot to on his plate this year too. He's going to be a name that if they don't start out ahead of the pack or right where with it, you know, you're thinking about Rodgers, you're thinking about the coach, you're thinking about other changes, and the Jets have just been in this hamster wheel for so long, and they're doubling down after last year, and boy, is that a risky bet, but if it pays off, it pays off big.
You know I'm big on NFL.com. To all of our audience here, that's where I get a lot of my information, especially about who's healthy, who's not, contracts, the countdown, the insiders, NFL.com, the NFL insiders, Eric Edholm's one of the better ones out there. Now, I got a chip on my shoulder. I just was in Costa Mesa. I'm going back, and I think the Raiders are getting no respect. They won 8 games. They were pretty good. They added Christian Wilkins and went out and got a great defensive player overall and got Brock Bowers and Michael Mayer, and I think they're better than most people give them credit for, but the Chargers weren't very good, and everybody thinks, what, Harbaugh's 5-6 games better? And Denver's been a train wreck since Sean Payton's been there with their roster. It's obviously not a work in progress. It feels like a rebuild. So knowing Kansas City is the elite team, and the last time they lost was to the Raiders on Christmas Day, handicap the rest of the AFC West, because every time I hear about, well, Harbaugh and Payton are so great, they don't play. They don't throw the ball and run the ball. And, you know, everybody says just because they're there, they're going to eventually win. I haven't seen it yet. Tell me about those teams.
Yeah, there's definitely a prove-it factor, right? Even though Jim has this direct, short but brilliant NFL coaching record, and even though he, you know, sort of, not say struggled, but by Michigan standards, struggled early before getting to the mountaintop and really, you know, establishing themselves the last 2 years, but especially last season. So, I think Jim will figure it out eventually. I think, I mean, I'm that part of it, I'm not too worried about. But, you know, there's two teams in the division that have established quarterbacks and two that are having, you know, races right now, battles right now. Broncos have that three-way battle. Who knows? Is it Bo Nix right away? You know, do you start with a veteran? Do you give Wilson a shot? I have no idea. There's a lot to figure out in Denver. I mean, they're my team that I'm – I really just can't put much of a high ceiling on them until I know a lot more about that offense right now. But your Raiders are like probably going to be one of the, you know, 10 or 12 best defenses in the league, if not one of the 5 or 6 best if they're absolutely at their peak. You know, Antonio Pierce has obviously won people over. It's exciting to see him kind of, you know, sort of settle in a little bit as the head coach as opposed to trying to prove himself on a weekly basis. They had some tough, you know, arduous losses last year down the stretch. So they could have won a couple more, too. You know that. And I think there's just a cap on what they're going to be able to do offensively. I have a feeling they're going to give Aiden O'Connell every opportunity to win this and just hope that he's got that, you know, game manager plus thing going where he's, you know, most of the time he's making the right reads, he's working the offense. You know, their defense is going to keep it close, and then he can make 2 or 3 plays a game. If that goes according to plan, you know, they're in contention for second place, I think.
Eric, wrapping this up, Joe Burrow in Cincinnati, as we're spending a lot of time in the AFC, he's hurt a lot. And again, he's a brilliant quarterback when the pocket is clean. You got two receivers on that team, and Higgins and Chase, who are not happy with their current contract status, and all we're talking about this offseason is money. Everybody's getting paid, and Mike Brown historically, this is fact, not fiction, historically has been the cheapest owner, the way he runs a franchise, the building, the planes, and all of that, and he has to pay now because he's mandated, due to the salary cap, to spend this type of money. Do you think Cincinnati's going to be able to keep this team together in the next year or two to make another Super Bowl run? Where do you see them?
Yeah, I will say, as just a little bit of a counterpoint, they maybe not so much this offseason, but the two previous offseasons, they did go out and spend. It was out of character. It wasn't, you know, like, you're right to point out the fact that historically they have been a pretty frugal franchise and haven't gone out and, you know, signed the big marquee free agents elsewhere. Maybe that's good. Maybe it's bad. So they did kind of convince you know, Burrow, I think prior to his drafting, like, we are serious about putting a team together here, and they kind of kept it going. But, you lose your starting running back, and you're going to have to kind of piece something together in the backfield. But it really is all about what Burrow and those receivers can do. You have Burrow coming off the wrist injury. You know, the offense actually hummed pretty well without him. You know, I mean, that was interesting to me with Browning in there. But they obviously need him back and upright for most, if not all, the season. They're going to squeeze whatever they can get out of Higgins this year and then watch him walk in free agency next year. It just feels almost predestined at this point. And I think once kind of the smoke clears a little bit, Ja'Marr Chase will have his extension in place. But, you know, that's – you're banking on two guys who have been spectacular when they've been together but haven't always, you know, had the luxury of great health. So we'll see. They're gonna be as tough as anybody, and they faced a whopper of a schedule last year and did pretty well, all things considered.
Eric, as you leave us, can you give us one storyline you're covering that maybe no one else is, that you got your eye on, that looks like a big potential story we can check out at NFL.com?
Well, I think just, you know, we talk about quarterback battles. It felt like there used to be more. I mean, there are some this year. I mean, Denver, what happens there? I think that's really fascinating how they handle that. You know, we mentioned, obviously, the Raiders situation. New England, I think they're keeping the door slightly ajar for Drake May, but it doesn't sound like he's ready. Same thing with J.J. McCarthy. And then, like, the out of, you know, the kind of the left field one is Pittsburgh. If Russell Wilson continues to have calf issues, or this thing lingers a little bit, or if Fields kind of wrests that job away with his play, it's funny because everybody anointed Russell the immediate starter, but there are people who feel like Fields is going to have a say on this race at some point. So that's one I'm kind of watching a little.
Thanks, Eric. Always appreciate your work. Great catching up with you. Have a great rest of the summer.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric Edholm from NFL.com, part of our camp coverage of the Raiders in Costa Mesa, brought to you by the DiCastroVerde Law Group. The brothers have your back. If you get into an accident and injured, it's Alex and Orlando DiCastroVerde, proud partners of our show. Their family legacy is the difference here. From their father's great legacy coming from Cuba for what they built here in this community, you got to trust your attorneys. You got to know they're going to fight for you. You got to know they're there for you. You might not ever need them, but if you do need them 24/7, they'll help you. 702-222-9999. They've recovered hundreds of millions for their clients, and they've been family run since 1989. Las Vegas' personal injury lawyers, available 24/7. I trust them. They trust me. That's why we're proud partners. And they're a big part of why we're in Costa Mesa for Raiders training camp. The DiCastroVerde Law Group, the brothers win, and the brothers have your back. When we come back, we'll wrap it up on the other side. A couple of other quick points I want to get to before I head out on the road to Costa Mesa again and again. And then we head to Minneapolis for the Raiders. I'll be on the play-by-play call. Jason Horowitz will join us tomorrow, the play-by-play voice of the Raiders from camp.
Here it is. Swing, and this ball is driven to left field. Back goes De La Cruz. Back at the wall, reaches up. He can't make the catch. Home run, Seidon Rafaela. A three-run shot that gives the Red Sox the 5-0 lead here in the fourth.
Bobby, that's why you're an equal partner on the show. You get to play Red Sox when I wanted to hear a Judge home run. I wanted a Judge home run, and you play a Red Sox home run. So today we did Red Right 88. Hope you enjoyed that. We're down to the final four greatest Raider games of all time. I think you know where we're going. Number four coming up tomorrow from Costa Mesa. Snow Raider, thanks for being patient. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks, Bobby. Thanks, JT. To your earlier point with the autographs, I got Chester the Molester, Lester Hayes' autograph at a Safeway store in Truckee, California. Super nice of him to do that. I love it when it happens. For Red Right 88, I was 15 years old. I was in Colorado skiing. And it was so cold there as well. We stayed in to watch that game instead of skiing. What a game, man. What a battle. You knew the Raiders were going to find a way to win, and they did. And then, boom, Next thing you know, Super Bowl champ. Thanks for the great shows this summer. We're always listening.
Yes, thank you. And I remember, I remember watching that game as a kid, you know, in Long Island, New York, because that was my heyday too, you know, early on in the 80s watching that. And I couldn't recall back then when I was a kid in New York wondering why Pastorini broke his leg and Plunkett played. But that's real. If you look at the beginning of Plunkett and the break for Plunkett and having the wild card first ever Super Bowl and then Plunkett wins the first of two, Plunkett doesn't get two. He gets one if he doesn't win, coming off a Red Ride 88 and then going into San Diego with Raymond Chester in that great game. And again, we could. The next game after that is the AFC Championship game, which was a huge game, massive game in San Diego. I didn't have that in the top 10. I could have put that honorable mention in the top 10. We're not going to be perfect with this list, but the effort, I think, is pretty cool what we're doing here, most of it Bobby. Q is at practice and pads today. Can't wait to hear what he has to say. I'll be back tomorrow in the tent, noon to 2 tomorrow. Looking forward to that. That'll be a lot of fun. I'm not driving. I'm flying. Let's see how that works. It's not going to be. I'm not going to say a word after what happened. So let's just hope for the best, and then be out there through the weekend, and we'll be back here next week. So tomorrow from Costa Mesa, we have a nice show lined up in advance. Have a great rest of the day, everybody. Appreciate you listening to the show, and thanks for signing up to our YouTube channel. We're going to need that in the future. I got a good announcement with that coming on YouTube. JT the Brick YT. Listen to Q's show and get that LV Sports Network app on your phone so you can always hear the shows.
Raiders! Appreciate it. Thank you, guys.